everyone. Welcome to the Worship Artistry Podcast. My name is Jason Houtsma, and with me, as always, Mr. Daniel Ornelas. What's up, man?
Hey, brother. I'm doing good. I have to actually stay alive because you always say with me as always. So I have to stay alive for a very long time, at least as long as this podcast goes. Otherwise, you won't be able to say that. That's the reason I'm working out and being fit so I can be on the podcast for you.
Well, you're doing better than me. I feel like you staying alive is a reasonable expectation. Like that's a reasonable hope in life that, hey, maybe you'll stick around to as long as this podcast is around. Like, you know,
that's good.
I mean, I don't see it going anywhere for a while, but at the same time, I'm not thinking I don't think you need to live to 100 to be on the podcast. Although that comes a lot closer for you than it does for me.
It really does. So what's going on, man, in life?
Well, I have to tell you how I woke up this morning, because when I go to sleep at night, I often will just listen to a podcast or something on a sleep timer. My brain is always running, and so it's hard to just shut everything down and fall asleep. And so I just listen to something boring that I know I'm not that interested in, and then I fall asleep. And last night, I left my AirPod in, and I fell asleep, and it stayed in all night, which it usually doesn't, but it did last night. And so I wake up to Siri reads in your, reads texts in your ear. So I just woke up to Daniel Ornelas says, come get it. I was just like, what? Okay, it snapped away. Quick, come get what? And I'm like, what's he talking about? And then I realized last night I sent you the picture of that guitar I was looking at in Nashville.
That's amazing. It was 6:30, right?
Yeah, 6:30 in the morning. Just Daniel O'Neill says, come get it.
Even in a South African accent.
Yeah, it is in a South African accent, which makes it even better.
That's awesome.
But it got me fired up, man. I woke up. I was like, let's go. Let's go get it. let's go make it a good day.
Yeah, come on. Fly to Nashville. Come get your guitar.
Yeah, I don't know. It's, when you're looking for that guitar that you've been looking for forever, you're really looking for one very specific thing. So any little thing about it, when you're like, oh, I don't know if I like that pick guard.
Yeah.
I actually like the pre-1960s pick guard. And it's a little concerning when somebody posts a picture of a guitar and it's like, hey, I'm selling this guitar. It's a good one. And the picture's blurry and there's no other pictures.
Yep.
You're like, I feel like you're trying to hide something there, guy.
Yeah, I can imagine. I mean, I know that I've bought stuff online. I bought a Rickenbacker once, a Rickenbacker bass.
Yeah.
And I didn't know then that the truss rods, it's got two truss rods. And there's a specific tool to get in there and adjust them. And if they bend over time, you can't get the tool in there to change the neck. So then that basically becomes less worthwhile buying something like that.
Well, I know that's, and especially with those kind of older instruments, they're not as consistent as ones now. So, you can buy, you're like, oh, okay, there's this 1951 Gibson LG2. And I'm like, that's my dream guitar. And then you play it and you're like, this sounds like garbage. And then the one that was made right after it will sound amazing.
Yeah, acoustics, that's so true for them specifically, right?
Right, because it's what piece of wood it was. And I mean, it's been really interesting, though. I've been kind of going through just kind of the history of the guitars and stuff. This all came down to, I was at a buddy's house with a couple friends. And we were talking, we're all kind of in our 40s now, And everybody's in that spot of like, one guy's like, yeah, I want to get some cars. Like he owns his own company, done really well for himself. And he's just like, I want a garage. And I want to get some like classic Porsches or whatever. Like he's just thinking about what kind of cars he's going to get. My other buddy is talking about, oh yeah, you can get this. And I'm not really a car guy, but I was telling him, I'm like, yeah, my midlife crisis. I'm just like, man, the thing I've always wanted is just this guitar. It's like old guitar. And they're like, how much is that? I told them, and they're just like, oh, you should just get that. So I said to Allie, when we were driving home, I was like, hey, all these guys are, everyone's having their midlife thing. They're all wanting cars. All I want is a guitar. What do you think? And she's like, yeah, get it. I was like, what? So now I'm officially on the hunt for this guitar, but it's...
And you're having a midlife crisis, but all good.
Oh, yeah. No, my midlife... I just use that as an excuse. My midlife crisis. Yeah. I had that more around 38. 38, 39 is when I was kind of like, I don't know. Everything's broken. I don't even know if I believe in God anymore. And then I did a podcast about that. That's common knowledge. So if you haven't heard that podcast, it's actually a really good one. But I do believe in God still and Jesus awesome. and all of that. So it was an amazing, time to go through. But I would call that kind of the midlife crisis. And then now I just really want this guitar that I've always wanted.
I
keep thinking of that scene in American Beauty when his wife comes in the house and she says, "What's in the driveway?" And he's like, "A 1962 convertible Mustang, the car I've always wanted, and now I have it. I rule."
That's amazing.
I'm just like, I just want to say that someday. But you don't rush these things. You don't rush these things.
No. Because you don't want to have midlife remorse.
Right. Well, it's funny too, because we went and checked one out down in Portland while I was down there. And it was, it was a 1951. It was beautiful. It hadn't been played a ton, and it had all this like reset work on everything, so it played really well. But it had also been kept in a really dry environment, and so it just had cracks all through it, which are not a big deal. You expect that with old guitars; they all have cracks. My Martin has, both my Martins have cracks in them. They're fixed. They're fine. But it was just like, I think I can do better, But my wife is sitting there listening to me play it, and she's just in heaven. She's like, "Oh, are you gonna get it? Like, it sounds beautiful. Are you gonna, I mean, it really sang. It was a beautiful guitar."
Yeah.
But then the thing is, I know that if I had bought it at that moment, and I'm all like, "I'm not sure. I got to think about it." All these kind of thing. I know that if we had gotten in the car and I had bought it, she would have been like, "Oh, I don't know if we should have done that." And I'd be like, "Well, I just bought this guitar. I'm so excited."
So I can imagine, man. Yeah.
Do you have any what's your kind of dream instrument? Are you playing it right now, or is there something Wayne's World, it will be mine? Oh yes.
Yeah, my dream instrument is a skinny flats boat that you can take in the Keys to catch tarpon on. No, I am actually playing my dream instrument. I'd like to have another Bluesman vintage jazz bass as well, but other than that, I love the bass that I've got. I did play Peter Furler has a bass. He has an old P bass that's from '60s that just sounds unreal, and I played "Blessed Be Your Name" on it. That song, I think that's the only reason that song did so well on the radio.
It's because
the bass you were playing. It's the bass I was playing. No, but like a really legit old '60s P bass. I had one '72 bass that got stolen flying from Nashville to LA. It never ever showed up ever again.
Oh no.
Yeah, and so that bass had like a it was a really, really cool bass. It had, I'm trying to think what it had, like a, what's the maple neck. So it was just a really cool bass. I played it on a lot of records. And so when you lose an instrument like that, that's a super bummer,
Oh, for sure. I know.
But then again, I got given some cash from the airline. Definitely not enough to cover buying another one of those vintage basses. But I bought this Bluesman vintage bass that I have of mine, and I love this bass. I think it sounds better, maybe, than the bass that I had. So yeah.
Well, it's also the player. It's not just the instrument. Well, and it's hard too, because when you're playing different instruments, you have, you get used to a certain sound, right? You have the one that you have, and you know how to make it really sing.
Yep.
And then grabbing a different instrument, sometimes it's like, oh, this is a different thing, and you have to decide, like, is this something I really like? Is it different? Like, I used to struggle so much when I would play shows live. Like, I would always just stick with one electric guitar because I would get my tone dialed in for my Les Paul, and then it was like, if I switched to my Telecaster, I would feel like, oh, that changed so much, and now I'm not sure what to do with it. It was like, it's quieter. It's all these things. And a lot of times I think with musicians, especially, you equate loudness with good. Right. Yep. So you're just like, okay, just drive it harder, make it louder, make it bigger. And so anything that went back from that felt a little naked. Now I've kind of learned how to go between those things and, and, and really get the most out of each instrument. But it definitely takes a while to go like, yes, I definitely like that one, and I hear these songs in that one, and I hear these other songs in this one, and you kind of work through.
That's awesome. That's awesome.
Well,
so who are we talking to today?
You. I'm talking to you.
Oh, awesome. Am I the special guest?
You are the special guest. No, it's funny. You and I always like goof around and talk about nothing for 5 minutes on every podcast, and then we have guests that we actually try and, you know, get some substance out of. But, you know, I've really this season I've really been enjoying just talking to the teachers. I think that there's a certain kind of conversation that you have, and you know, an artist's life is just very different than your typical gigging musician, right? No matter how much you want to glean from that, it's like their life is still just different, right? And it's something a lot of times we look up to and we go, oh man, if I could just be there, that would be awesome. But I was just making records and touring, and it's like, that's not real life. That's why so many artists make all these great albums early in their career, and then time goes on and then they have nothing to write about because they're just driving around in a bus all the time. And I'm not saying that always happens with like worship stuff. I get worship works a little differently, but even still, the challenges that you experience in those roles compared to the challenges that you and I experience in basic living and doing worship ministry like everybody else, they're different, you know.
Totally.
And so you and I got to talking the other day, and I was almost like, stop, we need to stop, we need to have this conversation on the podcast, because because it's important, and I think that we could actually, you know, speak into things that I think that a lot of people are probably really dealing with right now. So the question that we're going to kind of tackle today is the question of boundaries and finding for worship musicians what that really looks like, because it is a balance. And like, have you in your you've played in the band life, you do the worship leading, you're doing the worship artistry thing, have you been able to draw what experience have you had with drawing boundaries in your life as a minister?
Wow. Okay, and in regards to what specifically would you say initially as we talk?
I'd say just start off with your general music life. Like, I think the musician's life is just very different than...
Yeah, and in boundaries in terms of time or money or what are we talking
all
about?
All the above. I want to get your thoughts on boundaries, because I think a lot of musicians really struggle with what that means.
Totally, totally. I mean, definitely... So the conversation I often have with people is, you know, when you think about people that play golf, I don't know if I've ever said this on the podcast before, but people that play golf can go together on the weekend. They can dream all week about this, about playing golf with buy the golf magazines and check stuff out and think about what they're going to do on the weekend. And then they go out and they get their clubs and they go out and play a round of golf, and they come home feeling stoked that they'd had a good round, or they had like it wasn't the best round ever, but I'll get that next time. The difference between that and then a person that wants to do music, you know, you can't, you know, the thing about golf is they don't walk off the green thinking, I'm not playing against Tiger Woods, so I'm a complete failure. Mm-hmm. Whereas when you do music in any context, usually you feel like, unless you're doing it a full time for money, you know, and you're making a living, deriving your whole income from it, or you're on tour permanently, or you're playing, you know, or you have a lot of radio play or a lot of fans, you feel like, unless you are in the same league as, let's say if you're in a Christian band, as Mercy Me and all those guys, then you feel like, I'm not really cracking it because I'm not at that level. And we'd often see that when we'd go tour. And then the opening band would always be like, oh man, I wish, you know, I feel terrible. We don't do this for a living. And they had much better instruments than us because they were accountants and lawyers and doctors. And I was like, guys, you know, or the worship leaders, like, I wish I could be like Brenton Brown and Tula with you guys. And I'm like, you've got a worship leader job where you're driving a much better car than any of us own. And you got a really good salary and you get to be at home with your family. So there's all these interesting thoughts. And,
what worship pastors were you hanging out with that had the nice cars good salaries? Who are we talking about
the ones
here?
The ones at the churches we would play at where they brought us in. How many artists do you bring into your church?
Oh, zero. I am the artist that comes into my church. That's me.
You are. Yeah, exactly.
Hey, that worship artistry guy is our worship pastor.
Yeah, they're celebos. But you get what I mean, though. The idea that unless you are making a full living out of it, or and it's a weird thing because it's that way just with music or even with art. You know, my wife's selling a lot of paintings. She's had like commissions. She's in Kirkland's all the time. They use her paintings and they sell them in Kirkland's. And she just feels like, man, my career, I wish it would start to take off. And I'm like, babe, you're selling a lot of paintings. You do commissions. You got your stuff in Kirkland's. And but to her, in her mind, unless she's like at that level where she's in a big gallery, she feels like she's a complete failure. And it's weird how that is with art and music being art, same thing. It's different to sports, for example, or or any of the other hobbies that people might have, like fishing or whatever. You know, most people don't go, oh, I have to be a guide on a big river somewhere in order to feel like I'm a success as a fisherman. You just to get your stuff, you go out for fishing for the day, and you just have a great time. And if people can get over that and just enjoy music for the fact that it's you're getting to play music and you're getting to have your voice heard, whether it's to your local church or to a small room, you know, like a little bar, or you know, if you're getting to share your art at whatever level it's at, doesn't make it more successful because more people listened or more people bought it or it's a bigger stage or any of that stuff. If you can just enjoy the fact that it's art for the sake of art and that it has its place just the same as any other art in the world, I think you can really enjoy it a lot more. I don't know if this is talking into the boundaries idea that you're talking about, but
I was gonna say, I don't think that has anything to do with boundaries, but I'm interested in this one now because this actually speaks to a whole nother thing. We'll do another one on boundaries. We'll do another podcast on boundaries another time. But I think that what you're bringing up though is the idea of success, right?
Yes.
What is a successful musician? What does it mean to be a successful worship musician? What does it mean to be a successful artist? What does it mean to be, how do you define success? What is a successful ministry? You know, I think in the U.S., you know, in the Western church, a lot of it is defined by numbers. People look at numbers and they say like, well, we had this many people at church and my church is this size and it's growing and it's this successful. Right. Some people define it by, you know, how much money they make. You know, I'm someone who I am such a sucker for the movies that I'm not a movie crier, but the ones that get me are when somebody gets acknowledged for a lifetime of work.
Yes.
And then people just go, yes, you did great. Way to go. Like you impacted me. Right. Like that idea of success. But the things that those movies and those ideas kind of perpetuate is this idea of like a finish line of that at some point you're going to cross this finish line and everyone's going to acknowledge what you've done, and man, what a great deal. And you know, that might happen. It probably happens at your funeral, you know.
Yeah. like exactly.
If you do all right, you don't get to be a part of it. If you do the right thing, right? But that idea that like this is my definition of success. And I think that's something, you know, we were talking about having a midlife crisis earlier. I think a lot of people really struggle with that idea of what does it mean to be successful, you know. And I know for myself, that's been something that, you know, it never happens that way. You just kind of keep working and you go in a direction. Like I would say right now, like where worship artistry is at, for example, I would say we are successfully equipping church musicians and people who just want to play worship on their own, as well as churches, the whole deal. And we're doing that on an international basis. Now, we're not huge. I feel like we can do a better job of letting people know what we do, you know, like that is the space that I go, I want to be a good steward of this thing. I feel like God has placed this in my hands and I've worked really hard at it. And there's some things that I'm like, you know what? I can steward this better. I can do these things. I can take this to another level, but I still feel like, you know, I'm a success I don't even need to get the email, just knowing that people are learning. You know, when somebody says, hey, I've been struggling with this song and I saw your tutorial and I loved it and now I can play it really well. Like, boom, success.
Absolutely. You know?
In other scenarios, it's, oh, I've always wanted to play on the worship team and I finally got my first time and I was able to play, you know, stumble through this song and it was hard, but I did it. Success, you know, like,
yeah,
there's all these successes. It's not like a finish line, even in the, even from my, from the very beginning, you know, I was working, making no money for like, you know, working, making this library of lessons, not making a penny. And I remember being like, oh man, when I get that like first dollar, you know, and you get that first dollar, and my wife and I, we hiked to the up Mount Baker, and we made our little Ebenezer, and we just kind of like prayed and just said thank you, and we're like, all right, we, you know, we've made our first dollar. But like, I wasn't making, you know, it wasn't enough to do. I made a dollar. I didn't make, you know, $100,000. I made a little bit, right? And so it's like you're, so then it's like, oh, and then there's these milestones of then saying, okay, oh, then I got to the point where it's like, oh, I sort of have a salary a little bit. Like I have a third of what I need to make. Great. That's, but that's regular. I now have it. And you start kind of growing into those paces. There was never a moment that was like, I did it. You know, like I don't know what that looks like. And I think if I'm continually chasing that, and that's my definition of what a success is, I'll just never be successful.
I'm with you, man. I'm with you 100%. And it's so interesting because I read this book called Lust for Life, and it's a story of Van Gogh's life. And it was written based on all the letters that he wrote back and forth to his brother. All the facts are right there, because he often wrote to Theo. They wrote back and forth. So the person that wrote that book, I think it's Irving Stone, and it's basically, it's this whole story that Van Gogh died and hadn't sold any paintings, except his brother had bought his paintings. And I think there was one person just before he died that had put it in his house, and he met him and spoke to him, and he was very insecure, and he had a lot of stuff going on, but his passion to paint is just insane. So I read that book, and I gave it to my buddy, Steve from Civil Twilight. For 2 years, he never read it. And I was like, have you read that book yet? Have you read that book yet? And he said, I think it's in my brother's room somewhere. I said, dude, you have to read that book. He came to me after he read it, and he's like, oh my gosh, you know, because it makes you so inspired to create. My wife and I both, we read it. We just went completely, it's, makes you so passionate to create. And it's what it really is how hard his life was, and the fact that he still, despite all of that, all he could do was just, I have to paint. It's what I have to do. And so his whole process of him doing his whole life painting and never being recognized for it until he died, even, and then realizing his work after his death posthumous is like just an immense volume of work. That's the most prized work in the world, you know. It's just mind blowing that, and it just makes you realize that you know what you're saying into, you don't know what you're gonna reap. Sometimes you never ever will reap it yourself. But why does that make us so inspired? That's the thing, you know. It's not like it was a story of him just being massively like successful like Elon Musk. It's like this guy was so passionate despite not ever making it, and then you just rush off and want to just create, right? And so what you said earlier, though, you know, there's the balance between stop it going like, I'm satisfied, I'm successful, and then going, that's the ceiling of how far I'm going to grow, because you decided that's, I'm as big as I ever need to be, I'm a great success. That tension of actually saying no, there's still more, allows you to grow more and learn more and become better and become a more successful, as long as it's not out of an insecurity of like, I'm still not successful, you know, because you'll never ever be happy. But if you look at Bono and you too, they always were like, we want to do bigger shows. We want to do the biggest show on earth, and we want to make it look amazing. So I don't know if he was driven out of just the pure joy of it, or if it was driven out of an insecurity of like, we have to be the biggest, you know. But, and so you can either have, and that all comes down to how you end up feeling in your life and how you end up processing your own life while you're going, whether you're enjoying the ride or if you're hating the ride, because you'll never be satisfied if you want to grow and grow. And I'm not a success until we this. I'm not a successful worship leader until our church gets to 5,000 people, or we're not a successful musician until my song's on the radio, or, you know. And I remember when we moved to the States when I was out here first time with 363, we were about to release our second record, and the drummer said to me, man, I hope this record turns out to be really good and does really well. And I go, we've already made the record. It's either good right now or it's not good. I said, And I said, I really believe that it's an amazing record. It sounds, it's an incredible record. Whether people receive it or the record label manages to get it on the right shelf or whatever happens from here onwards is irrelevant. It's a good record right now as it stands, whether one person buys it or the whole world buys it. And so it's, and there's so many factors that go into whether it is going to be successful. Timing, you know, there's lots of bands that were out before their time, like the Benjamin Gate that from South Africa. They were before any other chick rock bands were even happening in the mainstream. They were a big chick rock band. So Avril Lavigne hadn't even come out, and they were just an insanely amazing rock band with a girl, you know. And Paramore used to be like little kids watched Benjamin Gate and were like, oh my gosh, and they became Paramore. So it's just, it's this interesting world with music. That just happens when people, you know, people, you never will really know whether your art or your music or your leading or whatever it is you're doing is doing more than you realize in the background, I guess.
Well, it's hard too to be able to separate yourself from the things that you're creating, right? Like, you know, I had this band a number of years ago and we were doing the whole thing. We were doing the battle of the bands and we got to play at Creation and we got to do showcases for label, the whole deal, right? Mm-hmm. And we're right at that point where we were like talking to a couple of different labels, had the possibilities of signing and all those kinds of things. And I remember looking at that as kind of one of those finish line things, like, oh man, if we could get a record deal, like that would be just so affirming of what we're doing. Because when you're creating something, like I cannot detach myself from it, right? Mm-hmm. I either love it or hate it based on my feelings about the song, right?
Yes.
I cannot listen to it like I can listen to every other song in the world, right? Yep. Where I go, I'm like, oh, this is my favorite artist and I just love this and I just get to sit and enjoy it. Like, it's always been my dream to just play backup in a band I didn't really care about. You know, like, I would love to play guitar and do some like BGVs in a great band that I don't care anything about the music. It's just fun to do. Because in that scenario, I don't have to feel any of the things that I feel when I'm creating something myself.
Yep.
But at the same time, I'm always going to create things because that's what's like built in inside me, right?
Totally.
But I wanted to go back to, you were talking about books. One of my favorite books ever. It was actually given to me by a guy who was the chaplain at the hospital. I taught him guitar a number of years ago, and he gave me this book called Practicing: A Musician's Return to Music by Glenn Kurtz. And it's so wonderful. It was right at a time, I read it right at a time when it was kind of in that, like, okay, my band is not doing anything anymore. I'm just teaching guitar. I love teaching. You know, it's, you know, people always say like, you know, those who can't do teach. And it's like, no, I was able to say I could do it because I went and did it and now I'm teaching. And I actually really like teaching, you know, like that's where I get the most, like when that light bulb moment goes off and somebody's starting to get it, it's like the greatest, like that's success for me that at this point, you know, it's just, when somebody's like, oh, look, I did it. The dopamine hit that I get when that happens is insane.
That's awesome.
But anyway, this book was about this guy who, you know, he had gone to music school. He tries to be a solo classical guitarist. And he just kind of realizes he doesn't have it, you know, to be at that level. You know, you talk about U2 or you talk about Tiger Woods, and it's funny. Our society idolizes these people, but never pays it. But and then is always shocked when they do crazy things, or when, you know, it's like when Tiger Woods started having trouble in his marriage and, you know, was having affairs and everything. I was like, well, yeah, duh. Like the guy's the greatest in the world at this one thing. If you are the greatest in the world at anything, you are an unhealthy, unbalanced person, right?
Probably, yeah.
Like there's not a whole lot of stories about people who have gotten to that level of anything that it's just like, oh yeah. And then I just come home and I have my family and life is good. And I just, you know, they're always so driven. You have to be, I mean, politicians are the same way. You know, I'm like, it doesn't matter who's the president or who's the kind of person that needs to make it to that point. They've had to have a certain kind of a drive, and they're like, I just don't think there's a lot of scenarios where somebody gets there and it's like, yeah. And then I was also a good dad, you know, I mean, sometimes maybe. But anyway, that's kind of like this book Practicing you know, he kind of realizes he doesn't have that drive. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it's kind of depressing. It's like when you've been dreaming about something as a kid and you've been better than everybody else around you at it, and then you're working towards it, and then you finally get to the point where you're like, nah, you know, I just don't have the ego for this. I don't have the drive. I'm never going to get to that level. It can be kind of depressing, you know? And what he actually does is he goes back, and this book has these beautiful descriptions of him picking up the guitar and just starting to practice again. And just the feel of the strings and the slow movements and the joy of the instrument again. And that becomes like the practicing is the success. It's not the like perfectly written song. It's not the amazing performance at Carnegie Hall. It's sitting in his apartment, just slowly playing through the instrument and recognizing like, that's like, this is beautiful. Enough. Right. Yeah. And the thing is, if that's the thing that you choose to find joy in, if that's the thing that you find success in those little pieces, like you said, they will actually drive you to get better. If you can find practicing as the like the destination, your journey will continue forever and you'll get better and better and you'll continually be inspired and you'll continually make greater and greater things. And then maybe someday, like I hope someday, I look back at my life when I'm on my deathbed and I go, yeah, I did everything I could, you know, and I'm satisfied and happy with it. And if you can get there as a musician, I think that puts you in a really healthy. Awesome spot. You're never going to be the best in the world, but you're going to be better because you're going to, you know, be a good parent and, you know, a good spouse and like be involved in your community and do all the things. Salt of the earth, you know,
exactly.
of the earth. That's what we're looking for.
Totally. Yeah, my son was actually asking me about yesterday about how do people get so good at their instruments, you know, and how do they get, because we were watching, he started playing the piano, and I said, how do you eat a whole elephant, my boy? And he's like, well, you can't. I said, yes, you can. If you ate a hamburger, elephant hamburger every day for about 3 or 4 years, you'd eventually eat the whole elephant. And he's like, whoa. So I said, yeah, that's what like practicing is like. If you practice every day and you eat an elephant burger every single day, suddenly down the road you go, whoa, look, I just ate a whole elephant. And people go, how did you eat that elephant? And you go, well, slowly, but like a bit every single day. And I said, that's what practicing is like. Unless you put in the time, you know, and you might not like elephant burgers initially, but eventually your appetite for it could develop. And okay, this is going nowhere.
Yeah. Your analogy is breaking down, because I feel like I'd get tired of elephant burgers pretty quick if I ate one every day.
It's true. You're
and
right.
In the realm of goals that I want to have in my life, I don't know if eating a whole elephant is like, that's the one I want to do.
No. And just to add a little moment, and my son said to me, what are the craziest things people have eaten? And I went on the Guinness Book of Records and I found people that have eaten an aeroplane, a bicycle. I'm not even joking with you, man.
Why?
And
Speaking of unhealthy people.
Yeah, one person eats clothes and she's eaten like 75 pairs of jeans. I don't know what it is. And it's just unbelievable. There's like these people have got these crazy eating deals.
I'll take the elephant in that scenario.
What's that?
I'll take the elephant in that scenario.
Yeah, over a bicycle. That's crazy.
Dude, that's amazing. It's funny with analogies. Just a total side note, I was having this conversation with my buddy the other day because I used to write songs with a friend of mine and in this band, and we would start, you know, in songwriting, you're picking pictures and metaphors and analogies and all that kind of stuff, right, as you're going, because you're trying to paint this picture of something to help grab this other idea, right? And he was so nitpicky about analogies, or, you know, simile, you know, because he'd be like, okay, it's like this, you know, that's a simile, right? When you say something's like this. And it would match up perfectly for this idea with all the context of the song, but it'd be like, but no, that breaks down, you know, five steps in, you know, it'd be like saying, oh, you fly like a bird. And it's like, okay, well, a bird but it has feathers. And so that's, we don't really fly like a bird. Like, it's like, well, I mean, you get the idea, you know, but it would always be, you know, you could get these really deep analogies that work and work and work and work. And then finally it was like, but who wants to eat an elephant?
Yeah.
You can't use it.
Amazing. Overanalyzing.
Yes, for sure. You can definitely do that. But I guess, you know, that's, as a musician, you're often navel gazing a little bit anyway, right?
Yeah, absolutely, man. Yeah, that's good stuff.
So do you feel so at this stage of your life, do you feel successful?
Yeah, I mean, it's such a funny thing. I was actually talking with the guys in my old band, 363. We got our little WhatsApp going this morning for the first time, actually. Daryl said, hey, I'm starting a WhatsApp with John and you and me. And we just talked nonsense for a good hour or so while we were, you know, working. And we were talking about stuff and, you know, thinking about it back in the biggest shows I ever really played were with that band, right? We're like Billy Graham's Last Crusade or any of the like 110,000 people, all these big events that we played at. And then I went to started playing with Brent and someone actually came up to me a few months or maybe a year after I was playing with Brent, and they said, wow, how are you handling this all? And I was like, what are you talking about? And he goes, well, you're going from that to this, like leading worship at a church with playing with Brent and Brown as opposed to playing these massive shows with Tree. And so I was like, man, I never crossed my mind once that that is less than this.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I didn't take a pay hit really, or there was nothing really that changed for me other than that the shows weren't as big. And the work environment was awesome. Brenton and I grew up together, so we have had a great friendship. It was just there was good things to and bad things in both scenario, and I don't look at one as better than the other. I just see them at different stages, and I don't have that. I never really ever had that burning like I have to be on stage thing. In fact, when I was growing up, my dad, when I was about 16. We started touring as a family around the world and singing as the Ornelas family, right?
I wish is there a video of that anywhere?
Oh, there really is. Oh, I can actually send show
it.
You.
I need to see it.
I had a little mullet going and everything. Anyway, at that point in my life, all I wanted to do was be a pro surfer. And so for me, being on stage with my family singing songs was like the least cool thing I could think of doing. So from those days, I never really ever wanted to be on stage. Then I kept playing. And eventually I thought when I went to university for music, because I thought that's what I was supposed to do. Then I was like, I guess if I could be Alanis Morissette's bass player, that would be a cool gig, you know?
Oh, yeah.
But like the idea of playing music or being in a band or any of that stuff was never really like driving force for me. I have to do this. It was more like, hey, if I'm going to be around people that are cool and we're going to have fun doing this, because I'd always done it since I was a kid. It was natural to be on stage or natural to play in worship, or because I did that from when I was like in school, in high school, I was already playing guitar or bass in church. So it never was like this thing that I discovered later on and went, ooh, I have to have that. So I never weighed up as less successful, more successful, and doing the insurance thing that I've been doing now, I don't feel like that's a step backwards or some kind of weird thing, because I'm still getting to create art. I feel more excited about the art that I get to create these days than I did before, because now I can do. Sam said to me, you seem like you're quite busy music wise right now and you're enjoying it. Is that true? And I said, yeah, because the pressure to make money from writing songs, for example, has gone away because I'm able to earn money elsewhere and not worry, am I going to be able to feed my family? And then, Brenton always jokes about it. He says, trying to write songs when you have a massive mortgage to pay is like tying your shoelaces in front of an oncoming train. It's like you got that anxious feeling like I should be out there making money doing something. Why am I sitting in this room writing something that could never be heard? Because the songwriting is like a lottery. You write and those songs, as far as income goes, I'm not talking about as far as the art side of it goes, because I sang the song Dad's Guitar this weekend at a good song. Thank you, man. Yeah, so I sang that this weekend at the montage gig that we just did with my band. And so like a whole bunch of different people came up and said, man, that song about your dad, that's freaking awesome. That I love that song. And so for me, that's success. And, I didn't say, well, you heard the song, you need to pay me something. So, and I haven't recorded that song and no one's got it out there. I've got some of my best songs that I've ever written with some people have never, ever come out on a record. And I've just got them on my hard drive somewhere. And some of them are just voice memos. Some of them are fully produced, fully recorded songs that just never had a home. We never put them out, never got them cut for film and TV or anything like that. But I still love them and they're like my children, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so success for me is being able to have the ability to sit down and write a song with people. And like, I've got this next couple of weeks coming up. There's a guy, Joel Ansett, that was one of the students that I had for CMI Academy when I was running that school. And I was the dean of that school. And there's two or three people out of that school that are making incredible music that I look at them and I go, my gosh, that's real. I'm a fan, literally, of their music. So, I mean, I choose their music when I'm driving along. I'll put their stuff on. And so, to me, the fact that he's making music and I had something to do with it makes me feel successful. But then I have other friends that I talk to and they go, how do you handle it when your friends do well? Because I can't handle it. I can't handle it if so-and-so that I know really well has a big hit song. It makes me mad that it wasn't me. And I get that. I'm not wired that way. I'm wired as a mentor as opposed to like this person that has to be the, you know, the guy. And that's not to say that there haven't been times where I felt like, oh, it's my turn now to do something. You know, when you're struggling to make money and someone that you helped is just making a fortune and you go, I helped that guy get there. He's not acknowledging it. and he's not saying, well, thank you, master, teacher. I'm like, that's not going on. And yet, it's not often that I get that way. And that's, I realize that's my shadow self coming back and going like, hey, what about you, bro?
Right.
So I feel like you're the most successful if people walk away from you and they're bigger than they were before. That's success in my mind. And that's why I find it very easy to enjoy, you know, enjoy everything instead of just thinking, oh, it has to be bigger or better for me before I get to feel like it's success.
Well, that so much comes out of identity, right? Like you know, it's funny. I've probably talked about this before, but you know, when I was in high school, I was the guy that was putting the band together. I was the guy that was practicing my butt off. I was writing the songs, you know. Same thing, college, same, you know, let's get together and practice. We had a band that was like really good. You know, mm-hmm. We were like winning competitions and stuff. We would only practice right before because nobody was like committed enough to want to do anything with it, you know? And so I was always the guy that like worked the hardest. And then I watched some of those guys go off and do really well, do the things that I had wanted to do, you know? And I'm sitting there like, but I was like, they're not even playing. If we're not playing, if I wasn't dragging them off the couch all the time, what, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And just that struggle and that sense of justice and like, no, it's not fair. Like I put in the work, I did these things and you see this other person succeed. And I remember how like the transition that happened for me in a lot of ways. Like I felt like I went through a season of life where God was just kind of pulling all that out, you know, just like, no, it does. Like, why does it, like, why do you feel like you're entitled to that? Like I did that and I've got something else for you. You've mm-hmm. been following me. What, like, who are you to tell me what to do? You know?
Yep.
But I remember like the transition that went from that being something that I said, oh yeah, I'm really happy for him. Like, oh, that's to something I actually felt, you know? And it was a journey from one point to the other. You know, it starts with that frustration, man. Why is everyone I know that I played with in college, it feels like everybody is doing what I want to be doing. And I'm up here and I'm, you know, playing at my church and playing in a band that's not quite making it. And is, you know, then like being more avant-garde and like trying more creative things that I still go back and go, that was pretty cool, you know, but
yeah,
just not the right time, not the right place, not the right person, all those pieces, you know, but getting to that spot where I remember my biggest, if I could distill it down, it was like God spoke to me was, you know, I don't want you to write songs for the church. I want you to write songs for your church.
Yeah.
And that was such a pivotal thing, because there was something in there about identity. There was something in there about like, I made you to do this. And you know what? It's probably not going to have the same effect that somebody who writes this other song that bridges the gaps and pulls all the churches together. Like, it's just not what I'm meant to do. I still love writing. I love the challenge of doing that, but I'm writing with like a person in mind, like this one person, you know? And it's like, oh man, if I know what they're going through and if I can write this song that can give them words to speak in that time, like I'm doing it well. If I can give my community something to sing that they connect with, like, oh my gosh, that's awesome. And when you connect it to, this is what God has called me to do, you know, same thing with like worship artistry. It's like this, I never had a big dream to do this. The opportunity arose and it just took hold in my heart and it took off and it was the culmination of like everything else I had done in my life up to that point. And it was like, oh, of course. But if God had told me like when I was in college, hey, just so you know, like, oh, here's what you're going to work towards. You're going to work towards, you're going to be a guitar teacher. It would have been like, yeah, but what about my band? You know, you know, and it's, but at the same time, I get so much joy and satisfaction. And I think, you know, walking in that way of that, that what God is pulling you towards and what the calling he's placed on your life and being okay and comfortable in that really kind of creates that satisfaction. And now I can just go like, okay, well, what else do you want me to do? You've given me something to steward. What else should I do? You know, and being able to follow that rather than, you know, march my own way that, you know, maybe isn't the best fit or whatever. So
perfect. Yeah.
I think I think we're both pretty successful.
I agree with you. I mean, one of the things I'll regret, and if I look back already at the years that I've done this, and a lot of people would say, wow, you went on tour with Taylor Swift and all that stuff. You did all this stuff. You did 363 and all that. And I would say the thing I regret the most out of all of that is how much time I was away from my family, you know, and you can't really have one without the other. Because my daughter had to go to school, you know, I could try homeschool them and try bring them all along, but they're all sitting in some venue, in the back of some venue waiting for me to play. It's just not their home. It's not that sustainable. I've seen some people sort of make it work, but just everybody's wives and everybody being on the road and trying to look after everybody and feed everybody and the woman not breaking down and saying, where's my stuff? I need my home. I need, you know, it worked well when my daughter was before she went to school and all that. But the years that I've had to be away from my family have been tough on us. And it's been, you know, it's a struggle personally and all those things that people don't see. They don't understand that is not straightforward when you're going to sleep in another bed, like at least half the year, if not more for your whole adult life.
Yeah.
So up until now it's, you know, the other guys are, I wish I could do that. I say, yeah, but you'd leave your wife and, you know, and sleep in a hotel room for half of your marriage or more. That's not great. Right. You know, it's not always the winner.
my wife's worst nightmare, she was incredibly supportive throughout the whole band thing. Like, I couldn't have done the things I did if it wasn't for her having like a steady job and like being able to have insurance and those things. Right.
Yeah.
Still have insurance, you know, like, her thing was, she was like, I just don't want to be like just running the CD table. Like, I have other things I want to do, you know? Yeah, and now she's an amazing, I don't even know what she is at this point. She does like some kind of program manager at the hospital, works for 9 hospitals, does all this stuff that's like helping out with all the COVID things, you know, like she's doing all this amazing stuff. And if I had been like, no, I need somebody back there to take care of the band money and sit at the CD table, she would have lost her mind. Right.
Yeah.
Cause that's not what she's built to do.
Yeah. And so exactly. Trying,
you know, kind of acknowledging that, I would say, if we're talking about regrets though, if I was to say I had one regret, it would be that I did not learn to sing until like way later.
Yep.
Because it always put me in a position where I had to count on other people and which, you know, it's good to be able to count on other people, but like when you're writing songs that you need somebody else to sing, those are things that are on your heart, right? Like it's just very different than when you can write for yourself and you can communicate what you want. And, you know, I'll never be the greatest singer in the world, but I can now write songs that I can communicate the way that I want them to be communicated. And I do feel like that would have opened up so many more opportunities if I had, and it was all based out of fear. It wasn't because I didn't have pitch or that I couldn't learn. It was just like, you know, I'm never going to be, you know, the American Idol singer. And so I don't want to, you know, and I had people force me to like do BGVs and that kind of stuff. And I was always like so insecure about it. And now it's like, well, you know, but then as I kind of, let's see, I got in my 20s, I started, like, I took some vocal lessons. I started kind of learning a little bit how to sing. I would say the last year or two, I'm now 42. The last, like, 2 or 3 years, I'm actually gotten to the point where I'm like, I actually really like my voice. I like it. I'm trying to reproduce that the best I can when I record things. I'm not trying to hide what it is. I'm trying to go like, this is, I'm trying to capture this, you know?
Yep.
But that took 20 years.
Yeah, it's true, man.
You know, to and get to that point, if I had started when I was 15, when you can learn things a lot quicker and had been singing and taking lessons and listening to the people in my life that were like, why don't you just learn how to sing, man? You can do it. Like,
yeah,
maybe things would have been different, but I probably wouldn't be married to my wife and I wouldn't have my two awesome kids.
And yeah.
I'd probably not be living in the most beautiful place in the country. So, you know, things work out. They work out like they're supposed to.
Yeah, they do.
But yeah, if you are learning right now, you should learn to sing.
I agree. There's two things. Secondly, you have to, if you're going to create the thing that has the most essence of your art is going to be songwriting too. That's one thing I regret a lot I meet a lot of people, you know, that have spent their entire life pursuing becoming an insanely good singer, but they've got nothing to sing about. They all sing covers. They don't know what to sing about because they haven't pursued the art of writing. Mm-hmm. And that's where the real income is. If you think about it, if you're trying to think of it fiscally, you know, music, the guys that I know that do really, really well financially are the guys that wrote the songs. and you know, you're going, oh, what? That's crazy. Like, and so someone like my buddy Brenton, who's written a lot of big songs, he just plugged away at it from when we were young. We both started writing at the same time. I only wrote because, oh gosh, we're putting out a CD. We better have something to write. So I would write a bunch of songs and then scrounge around my friends and grab some of their songs. And then, can we record your song? Hey, can we record your song? It was more like the mission of what we were trying to do ministry-wise was my focus, as opposed to what do we have to say as a people or as a band. So I never pursued songwriting until, and not seriously up until maybe the last maybe 8 or so, 10 years ago. And even then, like, you know, it's not something I wake up every day thinking, what should I write about? But that focus of just saying, it's also out of fear. People go, I don't want people to critique my song. So I don't want them to go, oh, that's not good. It's not a good song.
Oh,
but Brenton
will
tell you.
They will.
Yeah,
man.
They will.
It hurts. It stings at first.
Yeah. And Brenton says to me, if you could see how many crap songs I wrote this year, you know, just because he has one Everlasting God every 10 years or whatever it is, it doesn't mean that he that's all he wrote. He wrote a lot of bad songs. and even I'll even tell him, man, I don't like that one. And then Third Day will record that one. And I'll go, oh, okay, so it got a Grammy nomination. So I was wrong. You know, it's just funny, but it's what art is. Art is something that you can't really – it's such an interesting thing because some people really might like it and other people really might hate it. You know?
Totally.
And we were talking earlier about if you're just thinking financially successful, some of my favorite artists that I love listening to, if they didn't exist, my life would be so poor for it. And if they all went the route of going like, let's all be Nickelback, I would be very, very sad. Because those guys made a lot of money, more than Jonathan Brook or Sean Colvin. Or
supposedly everyone hates Nickelback so much, yet they were the most played band in the world. Like, they sold somebody CDs.
Yeah,
I don't
exactly.
know who it was, but
yeah. I mean, no, I don't hate them, but I just think though that you know, commercial success doesn't always mean that's the best success for everybody. And you know, some of those niche things are just so valuable to the world. Boutique churches, for example, where there's only 12 people in the church. No, but truly, I mean, It's true. If you find a community that's healthy, you know, you could find a little church that's super healthy that has 30 people in it, and then you could find a mega church that's a complete disaster, and they have all the people in the world, and they're pulling in a lot of cash and all that, as far as relationally, you know. So you can't weigh success up on financial or numbers. I agree with you 100%.
Yeah, more people, more problems.
Totally.
Yeah.
100%.
Well, you know, I could keep talking about this forever because I love songwriting and I love all the things. We could just rabbit trail forever, but there's other podcasts to be had. We are actually going to come back and talk about boundaries at some point because that was what we were going to talk about. And we've got some good stuff about that. Maybe that's a part two.
Yeah, that's my job security. That's why I kept that one out of the way so I could do another one.
Because you're so close to being fired. I just hate you so much. I can't take working with you. You're just like such a downer all the time. The worst.
Oh, man. Hey, there's one video I want people to go and watch if they get a chance after the podcast. It's called Vincent Van Gogh Visits the Gallery. And it's Vincent and the Doctor from Doctor Who. If you want to just epitomize this conversation we've had today and go watch that story of him revealing, you know, the art that he made in his life.
If you want to cry your eyes out,
just go weep.
You will cry like a baby.
And so that's just amazing to think that's what it's all about, really, at the end of the day, is you know, working hard to do the things we do without knowing potentially what they're ever going to do, and not worrying about the success of them, but rather worrying about the pursuit of them.
Ooh, that's a good one. I'm just going to stop on that one. Guys, if you want to go and go check out that video, for sure. It's Daniel showed it to me one time when I was at his house, and I was just like, who's cutting onions? You're not gonna get me. No. Anyway, he got me. If you want to go and actually work on your craft and work on learning songs, you know, Ryan said it a couple of weeks ago. You know, the first step to being able to create is to being able to copy. And so, when you're taking on worship songs and that kind of thing, being able to understand how those songs work together and the part that you play within them is a great way to grow your musicianship. And so you can go check out Worship Artistry. You can try it out free for 21 days. We've got bass, drums, keys, guitars for both acoustic and electric, and vocal harmonies as well. So we've got some amazing singers. We've had Kristen Joy on the podcast as well. And it's becoming this really cool thing to be a part of. I think we're all just like having the full team in place has just been really enjoyable. And I feel very inspired as we're making it. So I hope you feel that inspiration as you check those out. Like I said, you can try it for free. Otherwise, the other thing you can do, if you want to support this podcast, you can go to iTunes or Spotify or wherever you listen to your podcast and write a review. It is super helpful. Just having reviews gets us in front of other people. And, you know, that's where we want to be. We want to be good stewards of everything we're doing. And if you think we're talking about good things, go ahead and share it with some friends. We love that. Otherwise, guys, we'll see you next week.